This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Composer Philip Glass is a contemporary music icon. He was a pioneer in the minimalist style that captivated the art world in the 1960s, but back then not all music lovers were ready to embrace the new form. Much has changed since then, and over the last several decades, Philip Glass has been recognized as one of the greatest modern American composers. His film scores and operas, and he's written many, are considered extraordinary. And last year, President Obama awarded him the National Medal of Arts. Now at the age of 80 years old, Philip Glass continues to collaborate on music and art. A festival at UNC Chapel Hill this week celebrates his 80th birthday and his wide influence on art, music, culture, and thought. Philip Glass joins me now. Welcome. What a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Frank. I'm happy to be here.
I'd like to do a little biographical work, if we could. Your childhood, you started in Baltimore, and your father owned a record store.
Yeah, and that was very important. I was working in the store in those days. It was a kind of a mom-and-pop record store. It wasn't a big Virgin mega store. It was just a little record store. And at 12 years old, my brother and I were working there. He was 13, I was 12. So we were working in the store. But I grew up in and he had all kinds of music in the store. And we didn't talk about classical music or popular music. We talked about good music and bad music. So I grew up with a very broad a picture of what the music world could be like.
Interesting, too, because you'll get to see not only, you know, sort of nurture your own tastes, but you get to see what's selling and what isn't, right?
I mean, some of the fun things, I was in the store when Elvis Presley made his first records. And those records never got out of the box. We just handed them out. we sold them so fast.
What was your opinion of Presley when he came out?
I liked it all.
Yeah.
I ended up liking a lot of different kinds of music. And that ended up being very useful for me because I've worked with all different kinds of musicians.
You also went to college at a very young age. If you're 15, right?
I was 15.
Yeah. Were you?
I was at the University of Chicago. They had a program for young people, but I did leave home. And my parents didn't come with me. Mm. When I was 19, I came back home long enough to went up to Juilliard School of Music in New York. I made up my mind to. I had begun music in Baltimore at the Peabody Conservatory, a very good school, and there were very good players in Baltimore. You have to remember at that time, right after the Second World War, a lot of people came from Europe, and there were good teachers and good players, and that was a very good place to start music. I started as a flutist and flute and percussion. I picked up piano in Chicago, and I eventually became a pianist. That was really what I did.
You're known in your early career for your experimental style and experimental mm-hmm. music. Was that something that was interesting for you right away?
Well, you know, I didn't think of it as experimental. Yeah. I was studying in Paris with a very famous teacher, Nadia Boulanger, and I was in my mid-20s by then. And I met Ravi Shankar. He was there doing a film score, doing a film, and he was doing the film score. And I became his assistant, and I was friends with him until he died. And he introduced me to the idea of a global music culture. And from that, I began to understand Indian music through him. But after that, I had collaborations with people in Africa and Australia and China. So I got that was a very important part for me. So when you say experimental, I guess it was in a certain way, but it was also very traditional. I was working with people who came from very deep traditional backgrounds.
But things were changing, even especially in Europe, particularly because of the pessimism over two world wars, a very different idea about what the arts meant and approach to arts, would you say or not?
It's interesting. The arts have always been, in my view, it's always been very optimistic. And like today, when there's so much conflict in our country, the arts are booming. It's a great time for music, for theater, for film, and we know that. You can call it entertainment, you can call it art, whatever you will. But I always think it's Mother Nature has a way of balancing things out. When things get really tough in one area, there's always poetry, and there's music, and there's film, and there's dance. And there's a lot of that here where I am in North Carolina.
there is this form that you're famous for pioneering. You certainly weren't alone, and it wasn't only in music, the minimalist form.
Well, that word was invented by a journalist, a very smart guy who also was a composer, by the way, who wrote a piece called the Three Note Opera. It really described people who were going back to fundamental ideas of harmony and counterpoint after years of very difficult music to listen to. We call modern music. It was hard on the ears, and people thought it was hard on the soul. But I love that music too. I loved all kinds of music, so I didn't draw the line anywhere. But my generation wanted to go back to music that could directly appeal to an audience. And I'm not talking about necessarily commercial music, though I've done plenty of commercial music too. I enjoy that. I don't find anything wrong with it. So I've done film work and I've done commercial work, but I've done operas. And so what I did is I considered it all very open. And the minimalism was, in a way, it was the door that opened that world for us.
I was going to ask you about that. Is that something like minimalism, a very self-conscious way of approaching sound and music, right?
Well, you know, let's put it this way. My generation wanted to do something very different. Our teachers were writing music and playing to very small audiences. We're talking about people who were writing symphonies and string quartets, and it was kind of hard on the ears, and people didn't like it. And we said, well, if we were going to go into music, we wanted to play in front of people. When I was at Juilliard, I was a flutist when I first went there. But they said, oh, you don't have to play the flute anymore. Now you'll be writing music. Well, that was the wrong idea. In fact, I became a pianist. And now young people who are composers are playing music and writing music is not something that are different from each other very much. So last night I played with nine other pianists in this piece for 20 etudes. We each play two etudes. And one of the things that I liked about it was being around so many other musicians and being one of them.
But you wanted music that would be easy on the ears, a kind of reaction to stuff that wasn't, but there was pushback against the kind of music in terms of the popular.
You can say that was pushback, but the older people didn't like us very much, but we paid no attention to it whatsoever. I mean,
how important was it for you as music itself, and how important was writing that kind of music and thinking in those new ways just to open up new avenues of thought?
Well, you know, it opened up much quicker than we thought it would. Yeah. When I started in New York, and when I came back from being in Europe, I was just about 30. I started playing in storefronts and lofts and places like that. Within 7 years, I was at the Metropolitan Opera House. That is very, Frank, that is super quick. What that tells me was that there was a world waiting for a new music, and my generation were the people that just happened to step through the door.
I've read that you were deeply influenced by the music of Franz Schubert.
Oh, right? Yes. Well, my father's favorite composer was Franz Schubert. And after a hard day at the record store, he would come home, have dinner. He would come home at 9 o'clock at night, and he would stay up and listen to music. And he listened to Schubert. I was, even as a very young kid, I would sneak down on the staircase and listen to him. I was listening to music with him. He loved Schubert, but he also, Frank, that was interesting, he wasn't a trained musician at all. He was actually a car mechanic who began one from fixing car radios to selling radios and selling records. So he came to music very late, and the records that he couldn't sell in the store, he would bring them home to see what was wrong with them. Now, so the things that you have to remember, this is the 1940s, so he would bring home, it was Shostakovich, Bartok, Hindemith, and he listened to them over and over again. The more he listened to them, the more he liked them. Of course, that's the thing, the trick.
Yes.
If you listen to music, if you become familiar with it, it opens itself up to you. And he became, in Baltimore, his record store became the place to go to for modern music. And I worked in the store. At the age of 15, I was the record buyer for the store.
Well, would he do things like say, no, listen to the, somebody says,
oh, he did do that.
And
he
says, no, wait, listen.
No, he said, Louis, take this record home. If you don't like, these are 78s, by the way. And if you don't like it, bring it back. Of course, they never brought it back. they love my dad, and he was a purveyor of new music, and I knew I listened to everything that he listened to, and I listened to it with him. So when I first heard that music with him years and years ago, and besides Schubert, that was what he really loved. But he loved Bartok. He liked Stravinsky.
Well, that's interesting, too, because when you think about Schubert, at least my understanding is that his initial critical reception was, well, it's all very sweet. He writes very nice music, but not very deep. And then over time, critics and scholars began to realize there was a lot more depth.
We critics, I can say, those of us who are, it's easy to make a mistake. It's easy because we just don't know. You don't know what you don't know. That's the old story.
I want to play a little clip of music, and obviously we're preparing for a 20-minute conversation with Philip Glass, and then we think, well, what music are we going to play? And there's so much to choose from. Let's play a little clip from Einstein on the Beach and talk a little bit about that. So let's play this clip right now. That's Philip Glass, who's now squeezing the headphones to his ear, and sort of, I think that was a cringe. What was that expression that you gave me?
Because you picked a piece that is not easy to listen to.
Well,
and I was talking about how I was trying to, but the funny thing is that people liked it.
Yes.
It had a strong rhythmic feeling to it.
Yeah.
I was very influenced by, I have been living in Chicago, as I mentioned. I had, and 56th, 57th Street, jazz clubs there, and I heard Billie Holiday. That's how young I was, or how long ago that was. And people like Charlie Parker, I could hear the people, Bud Powell. So that energy of that music got into my skin. And later, much later, when I was writing music, I found that it offered a kind of a language, which was emotional and familiar. And when I listened to it, I'll say, yeah, I guess that was pretty tough. But you'd be surprised. When I said I did that concert at the Metropolitan Opera House, I was 37 years old, Einstein on the Beach, sold out. Mm-hmm. And no one knew who we were. And then it sold out the next week. And they said, we will do it next week. And then we discovered that we were losing money, because you have to understand, operas lose money. We all know that. But we didn't. Bob Wilson and I didn't know that. So we didn't know that every night we were there, we were going into the... Well, we had just come back from a tour where we were losing money. We were that innocent to thought that, well, we're selling out houses. And we found out that we had lost a lot of money. And we couldn't afford to do it anymore. We were not a foundation. We were just two guys who were trying to make something.
You talked about the influence of this music and what was going on in your minds. Again, there's a movement that's sort of working itself around the music you're doing. Journalists are trying to describe it. How would you say that that your music, the music that you were writing, and what was happening in jazz at the time, which was a particular type of music?
Well, I knew Ornette Coleman pretty well. He was pretty much my age. That was going into a very expressive, radical period, too. The free jazz movement, Pharoah Sanders and people, Cecil Taylor, wonderful music. I had by that time moved to New York, I started off listening to bebop, and I ended up listening to free jazz. Well, that's what happened, and it happened whether I had stayed in Chicago or not. But I was in New York, and I got along with the. I got along with jazz musicians very much, and in fact, Ornette and I, we talked about doing a record together. We never did. We always thought we would have time, and he died before I did, and I said, well, we just waited too long. We just never did it. But for my own entertainment, I would go to jazz clubs all the time.
I would guess that you might be loath to make these kind of distinctions, but is there a fundamental difference between that movement and what was impelling that movement and what was impelling you and other composers?
Well, let's put it this way. from a social point of view, we were very similar. We were not recognized. Free jazz was considered very radical. It had the main places to play were in the East Village of New York. But I was also working in the East Village of New York because I was working in the theater then. I was working at La Mama in the public theater. So that's how the reason we got to know each other. We were working in the same places. I did not play jazz, and I never thought I was an improviser. And my music was all written down. I was talking to Ornette, and I said, Ornette, he said, we got to play together. I said, well, no, what do we do? He said, well, your band in the room and my band in the room, and we just start playing. Now, that was his idea.
Is that your idea?
Well, I didn't know how it was going to work. Damn it, we should have tried it. It would have been something.
I'm talking with composer Philip Glass today on The State of Things. Philip Glass at 60 is at UNC Chapel Hill, a celebration, 10-day celebration at Carolina Performing Arts, and what a pleasure to have you on the show. Continue this conversation. You've also done film scores. You talked about the operas. I want to play one, a film score. You won a Golden Globe for one of your works, The Truman Show, in 1998. Let's listen to a little clip from the theme. From Truman Sleeps, a composition by my guest, Philip Glass, who looks 60, but in fact it's Philip Glass at 80. I think I just said 60, but you do look 60 and younger. Tell us about that, about writing for film. I mean, do you go to a different place for you?
I got interested in film writing. First, people were doing experimental films. A film called Koyaanisqatsi Scotsy. Some people will know it. Film of just images and music. Didn't have a story. That's how I started with the film and with film work. And then Paul Schrader asked me to do the music for a film called Mishima, which is another very interesting film. These were kind of really art films. But at a certain point, I was living in New York, but I was going down to – I had a very smart guy working with me named Jim Keller, and he said, if you want to write films, I can get you some work. And he went to Hollywood. His brother lived there. And I started – writing film scores. That was in the 80s and 90s. I probably did 30 or 40 scores, which is not a lot, by the way. When I met Elmer Bernstein before, before he died, and I said, Elmer, how many films have you done? He said, probably 100.
Is it fun work, that kind of work, especially if it's going to be a popular film?
I enjoyed film work a lot. Yeah. First of all, it is commercial work, and sometimes it's commercial, sometimes it isn't. But the amount of talented people in L.A. is astonishing. I mean, they're filmmakers, they're cinematographers, they're designers, they're actors, they're musicians. It's New York without the dirt and the grime and you're in Southern California. I never lived there. I would go out there and work for a few days, and I would look at the movies, and I would go home and write the music at home, and At that time, I insisted on recording the music in New York. And at first, the studios didn't like that. They said, no, you're supposed to record it here. I said, no, I want to record it in New York. So then they discovered if I did it in New York, they could come to New York to hear them, and then they could go to the restaurants. After all, they liked coming to New York. I made friends among the film composers, and I enjoyed it very much.
Philip Glass, what a pleasure. Thank you for being on our program.
Happy to be here, Frank.
Philip Glass is a composer. He's in North Carolina for a festival highlighting his work at UNC Chapel Hill. Glass at 80 runs through Friday, and we have the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, Hari Kondabolu talks about parents and politics and much, much more. Stay tuned.